The RNIB welcomes you to the Mobility Challenge. Every research study and insight report confirms the critical role of mobility as an ingredient for independence and confidence. From getting around your local area through to more complex navigation, mobility remains a significant challenge for blind and partially sighted people. This session will offer a range of innovative solutions which aim to tackle the mobility challenge using a variety of human-centered smart technologies. Our panel will contextualize these technologies and highlight key opportunities and challenges.
Welcome everybody to the Mobility Challenge session. So in today's session, we're going to explore why getting around remains a stubborn challenge for blind and partially sighted people and how technology is changing that. So my name's Jim Sanders. I'm the Director of Transformation at RNIB. I'm about 2 meters tall, short brown hair and glasses, and like a Steve Jobs wannabe, I'm wearing all black except a teal jacket. So today I've got a really great panel of experts. Now, I was thinking last night in my hotel room, how can I convey the weight of knowledge and insight that this panel has when I'm introducing them to you all? And I had to think, and I think I've come up with it. So combined, they bring over a century of experience working in innovation, tech, and the disability space, all while still looking remarkably youthful. So please, can you join me in welcoming Jean-Marc Fagali, Pete Osborne, Manny Gupta, and Neil Barnfather. So we're going to start off with a quick fire 90-second introduction from each one of them so that you get a bit about who they are and a bit about their background before we open up into a panel discussion. So over to you, Jean-Marc.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Jim. And thanks again for having us back again at the Inclusive Design for Sustainability Conference. I guess we did it right the first time and now we're back.
Absolutely.
Which is great. But I'm Jean-Marc, WeWalk's Chief Innovation Officer. I'm wearing navy pants, a navy blazer, as I've been told by Jim. So I hope that's accurate. Brown hair and brown eyes as well. And at WeWalk, we're actually a team of almost 30 people with lived and professional experience of visual impairment. We've taken a standard wide cane, we've chopped off its rubber handle, and we've improved it with upper body obstacle detection and patented connectivity to our WeWalk smartphone app. WeWalk can talk to you, you can talk to it, and it'll give you instructions like head forward, turn right, where your bus will be waiting for you. And we've got some fantastic partnerships. We work closely with people like Guide Dogs UK, the RNIB, the CNIB. Not just saying that because they're all here. But they truly test and validate our products and act as gatekeepers to our community. So we're so excited to share all of this knowledge that we've brought together here today. But over to you, Pete.
Hi, I'm Pete Osborne, Deputy Chief Executive Officer. It's the front tooth missing, I'll just blame that, for Guide Dogs. It's great to be here amongst you. And the first description I had of myself, I was told if I gave that, I'd be walking home. So I won't give that. So I'm probably in my mid-ish, latest 50s. I'm a veteran of the sector, I was described as recently. So I probably add up to most of the 100 years or so. I've been working with Guide Dogs for about 10 years. And prior to that, I worked in RNIB. So I have context in both organisations. Guide Dogs' role, really, we want to be at the forefront of tech-driven navigation, simple as that. So it's a huge statement and something we're very very proud of. It's part of our strategic intent going forwards. And we know that actually technology affords a huge opportunity for us to scale access. And I think it was a real interesting point from our colleague in Meta earlier that actually the scalability of what we're all trying to do is crucial for all of us going forward. So we're looking to find solutions that are scalable and that work alongside other forms of mobility. And I'm a firm believer in choice. It's important for you to have the choice to be sighted guided, to use your cane, to use your guide dog, and all three, if that's what you choose to do. And I think technology actually affords an overlay to that with some of the solutions that we've got now. A previous manager described me as having my patients surgically removed, so I'm keen to actually get technology into the hands of people now. I think that's absolutely crucial. And you can almost taste it. I don't know what you guys think, but you can almost taste the possibility now. And I think that's where we want to go in the future. So I think it's going to be a really exciting session, and hopefully you're preparing some really awkward questions for us as well.
Thanks, Pete. Over to you, Manny.
Hello, my name is Manny. I'm a new kid in that town, I should say, for accessibility. I've been in technology for 30 years. I'm wearing a blue suit and striped shirt, which I always love from my corporate run. I'm a new entrepreneur, but I'm wearing a different kind of a glass. It's not just a smart glass like Raven. It's a smart augmented reality glass. And that's what we work out on that. We do AI programming on top of it, making them much more smarter than what they can provide. It's an industrial product, but used for the first time in social side of it. Purview, I represent as a managing partner for Purview Technology. It's a Scotland-based organization. We are an immersive tech company. And for us, we are creating next generation of augmented reality aids for any sensory impairment, sight, sound, and speech, because we feel the fusion of AI and AR can solve a lot of the things that AI can't solve on its own. For us, universal design, as Google friends talked to you about yesterday, for us, accessibility and inclusivity is complete. We are not at core in of the big consumer market. We are not a dot in that. For us, we are designing a very specific product just for the special needs of people with sensory impairment. Okay. Secondly, I'll say also the kind of technology or the wearable we are using, we want to move away from the dependency on the mobiles. Okay. So that Raven guys never show it, but fundamentally it's not just a glass, you always need a phone. We feel in a home you don't need it. These are independent glass you can have run on it, it runs its own Android platform and it can process on its own. So we want to create a wearable which is independent in its nature and still process the AI as it needs to do it. So we are evolving a product along with that. And yes, a lot of things we heard yesterday about also not all the data you want to do on the cloud, thanks to these kind of new products that you can do also local processing, for example, your friends and family photographs. You don't want to put them on a cloud. You can actually store them and process out here for recognitions. So in our entire scenario, we have in our product portfolio, we have Seva. We call them speech-enabled visual assistant. This is a product which I'm wearing right now, but we have other products for Mathly, for hearing, and also for speech. We are doing a new product called Silenta. And so we are new in the game and totally committed to this passion.
Thank you. Thank you, Manny. Right, over to you, Neil.
Thank you, everyone. I'm probably known to quite a few of you. I'm Neil Barnfather. I'm the Chief Commercial Officer at Goodmaps. We're an American printing house for the blind founded organization. Started with a very obvious mission, which is how do we help people like myself and many of you here who are blind and low vision navigate complex indoor spaces? We've seen a plethora of technologies over the years which have aimed to solve for this problem using hardware infrastructure and other visual anchor points built onto the walls and other surfaces and things. But none of them have really, to our mind, proven to be successful for aiding in a navigational context in complex environments. But more than this, they often act as barriers to deployments because of things like infrastructure, hardware, sustainability, and so forth. So Goodmaps was created with the first technical question of how can we do it differently? How can we do it infrastructure-free? How can we do it in a way that provides a level of accuracy that's necessary to help people like us navigate? And then beyond that, how can we come up with something that's easily scalable and can be deployed widely? We were founded in 2019 and launched our first product into the market in 2020. In 2022, we released the new app that's the one that's in the App Store today. And if any of you have used, you'll see and experience. The primary shift of the change has been the evolution from just serving those who are blind and low vision to meeting the widest possible needs, research-backed by people at universities, so independently peer-reviewed, which allows for a very broad number of people to use it. And today, the technology is available across North America, South America, 11 countries in Europe, and as far away as Australia, which really is a testimony to how people want to be able to access environments. If we think about the challenges of accessing healthcare and so forth, and travel opportunities and job opportunities, if you can't get into the place, how do you even get there? And that's what we do. That's pretty much me. My own 2 years as a blind chap and lived experience in that context.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thank you all for joining us today. So I want to set the scene a little bit. So my first question is going to be for you, Pete. Why does mobility remain a significant challenge for blind and partially sighted people, despite some of and all of the technologies which we've heard of?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think one of the challenges that we face actually is, how do you describe the problems we are trying to solve? This is not a technological question. This is a bit more of a philosophical question in a sense. For most people, actually, most people in society, they're actually quite amazed that blind people take regular breaths, let alone get out and about independently, let's be honest. So actually, being able to describe, you know, the problems that we face and the solutions that we need to find to address those problems, it is quite a challenge for us in the first instance. And I think we've done an okay job on that so far, probably give us a B minus or something. You know, I think it's really important for us to focus in on the challenges that we're trying to address. We are, in many ways, in this room, many of us technologists, but there are thousands of people out there in working in all sorts of sectors who can help us join the dots to address those challenges. And I think if we get really good at describing problems, I was really struck by something I think Robin Spink said yesterday, we shouldn't focus on writing lengthy papers and lots of standards. We need to focus on video, you know, get this thing into a 20-second TikTok, or the social media are available, clip that actually shows you what these problems are. And I think if we'd actually really do that and focus in on that, that will actually help us address the challenges. So I don't think we've been that great at doing that so far. We've focused very much on the traditional forms of mobility, sighted guiding, using a cane, using a dog, etc. And we need to actually take that right back to describing the challenge that we're trying to address and how technology might help us to address that challenge.
Brilliant. Thank you, Pete. That's really interesting. So our inability, or we haven't yet articulated really clearly the problems which we're trying to solve, which means we're not managing to calibrate the technology towards them. That's really interesting. So Jean-Marc, from your experience, what are the most pressing barriers that prevent blind and partially sighted people from travelling independently today?
Yeah, of course. And this actually builds perfectly on what Pete was saying, which is oftentimes we end up designing for accessibility, but we don't actually design for usability. So accessibility is how well can someone just access the service? But usability is how well can they access the service to actually do the things that they want to do? And the thing is, mobility is a bit of a derived demand. Having great mobility is fantastic, but oftentimes we use mobility to get education, to get to employment. And unfortunately, when people design technology, again, they focus on that theme of making the technology work, but not necessarily making the technology work for what users want to achieve with it. And I can sort of reflect on my own personal experience here. When I was in university, a century ago by this point, if we're using those numbers, I was visually impaired, and I found that sort of around 5 or 6 p.m., because I have LCA, which is similar to RP, very little night vision, I was very much disincentivized to go to evening lectures because I genuinely didn't have confidence in my mobility. That, and I also didn't really like soil mechanics. But at the same time, it doesn't just affect me. It affects a global population. It's why we see, you know, huge numbers, like what, 63% of visually impaired people having some sort of loneliness or social isolation. And again, giving an example from WeWalk now, it really takes just reaching thousands of users. So for us, with our first version of our smart cane, which was launched back in 2019, we took on board, you know, hundreds of thousands of user feedback hours, thousands of users in over 100 countries. And it took us to realize that, wait a minute, for obstacle detection, people don't necessarily want to know where not to go, but they actually want to know where to go. With our smart cane one, it would sort of beep to let you know that something was there, but it wasn't sensitive enough to tell you how to get around it. With smart cane 2, after using all that feedback and our partnership with the RNIB, we had about 50 different iterations of this over here. That's a horn. That's an ultrasonic sensor with a horn that's been iterated 50 times to allow users to then use it to shoreline across walls without it buzzing or vibrating all the time, while still maintaining enough accuracy to be able to detect that low-hanging tree branch. So now instead of WeWalk just telling you that, there's a tree branch there, you can actually use it to shoreline on a wall and follow a route as well. And not many people have thought of doing obstacle detection in that way. And I think, Pete, that goes very nicely to complementing guide dogs, you know, helping people go where they want to go rather than where not to go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jean-Marc. So you've touched upon how human-centered smart technologies are starting to help. So, Neil, can you talk to us a bit about how AI, computer vision, LiDAR, and real-time data can enhance wayfinding and navigation for blind and partially sighted people? You know, building on what Jean-Marc
said. And I think you're absolutely right. The what both Pete and Jean-Marc have said is really interesting, because what we're really talking here is about the fact that we as people want to be able to go where we want to go, and we want to be able to get there efficiently and effectively. And one of the problems with traditional approaches to these things has been, oh, we'll put a tactile strip from A to B, or we'll sort of, you know, do some form of delineation that allows a person to follow or you know, track a particular route. But actually, as human beings, we want to go where we want to go. We want to start where we want to start. We want to end where we wish to end. And to achieve that, we need to really reinvent the way we consider the problem. And that's, you know, that's very much at the central heart of the theme of what Pete said and where Jean-Marc sort of leaning into here. And, you know, for us at Good Maps, that's meant using AI to allow our handset, a person's smartphone, to say, you are starting here. We're comparing, you know, hundreds of thousands of potential locations in a venue, and then saying, this is exactly where you are. Here's everything in this space. Which one do you want to go to? And then providing the most efficient route to you, whether that's step-free, whether that's avoiding heavily populated areas, perhaps concourses at a railway station and so forth. And that's really the sort of combination and culmination of bringing these technologies and these approaches together, is providing a choice, providing an option, and saying to people, you can go anywhere, which is something we've not really had access to before. And I still almost have to sometimes pinch myself a bit and sort of say, actually, I will go and get a coffee this time. And it is available, and I can do that. And, you know, we've all, I mean, you know, I always say, if you bring it back to the most fundamental thing, you know, we see it in the data, but this is backed up. I always point out, like, you know, we have dashboards available to show where the most popular destinations are in railway stations. And the number one destination, a toilet, because people can't find them. And, you know, when we start building on it and we say we use technology to just deal with the most fundamentally basic things, that's something that's an amazing starting point.
Do you want to build on that, Jean-Marc?
Yeah, of course. And I think just building that, it's giving people the confidence to want to do those things, right? Like, the technology is great, but we actually did a study and we got some visually impaired people in a room, some with better visual function than others, and we put them in a group. And we found that even if a person had better visual function than the other, was able to see the room better than the other person, the person that was more familiar with that room had a higher walking speed, had a bigger desire to get to the end of the environment that we'd build. And I think that's something we're kind of striving for. Yeah. We're not just telling people, oh, well, it can tell you where everything is. It's going to make you want to get out there. It's going to make you want to grab a cup of coffee. It's something that's dependable as well.
I think that's really true. And, you know, for me, having had some functional vision and been able to walk around independently, you know, with pretty much a symbol cane, even though mobility and orientation instructors in the room would have said I should have not have been just using a symbol cane. You know, the truth is that there's something magical about the confidence that's elicited from a piece of technology telling you, you are going in the correct way, 100 meters, 50 meters, 30
for sure
meters, 10, turn.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, when that happens, it gives you something back. And I often lament to people that, you know, I used to go through London Euston in 3 to 4 minutes as a sighted person. You know, as a blind individual, that bumped up to anything from 20 minutes to an hour plus, depending on time of day and everything. I'm back to 3 to 4 minutes all by myself. I have me and a guide dog, me and a long cane. Yeah. And that's just phenomenal.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Okay, so Manny, can I bring you in here? So can you talk about how solutions like WeWalk, Good Maps, Purview AI-driven smart glasses, how do they fit into a broader mobility ecosystem? Yeah.
So good, very good point. You know, mobility, first as a technologist, you know, we try to kind of slices down exactly what mobility is in a, from a technology challenge perspective. And when we see mobility, it's actually a three-phase decision which our human brains does it, you know, very automatically. First is finding orientation. You know, if I'm here, the mind has to tell us or something has to guide us where there is the way out, where I can move around, where is a space to go around. The second one, the second part of the jigsaw is situational awareness. So as we start moving around, things might change. How can, quickly I can be make aware of that situation and be warned about it so that I can change and take a better decision. And third is all about direction, where I want to go. That can be indoor or outdoor. So I think in the room here where we are sitting, we all have that solution, because what I do with my glass is only orientation. And if I see what good map does is indoor direction. And a cane can give you the proximity situational awareness while also providing a distance out of it. So the whole idea is that, you know, as a, when I was growing up, I always get interested into a tale where six blindfolded people were trying to find and describing an elephant from their own part. Mm. We were all describing in our own way. But when we come together, we can actually solve this elephant in the room. Mm. So I think that's what the focus is. I think everyone is working from their own POV or from their own product. Mm. But there is a situation, and first thing is mobility is not a single problem statement.
Yeah.
It needs to be sliced and then collaborated to make the right solution.
Thank you very much. So that's really interesting that we've got a whole load of technologies developing around some very specific use cases, and it's about how we knit all of those technologies together to do the open space discovery that Neil was talking about, not feeling like, you know, I'm tied to a route and I can't, you know, go off that. Okay, so Pete, can you help us contextualize that a bit more? How do we ensure that these different technologies integrate into daily life, public transport systems, pedestrian infrastructure? There's a whole load of hard infrastructure out there already that these smart technologies need to work with. How do we ensure that they integrate?
Yeah, I think one of the ways in which we can do it is to make sure, as we are doing through events like this, that major developers and indeed not so major developers are actually thinking about this quite deeply. I think there are some really interesting opportunities in terms of transport infrastructure and how that develops to make sure that actually we design for all as we redesign that. If we're going to spend hundreds of millions of pounds redesigning something, let's make sure that it reaches as many people as it possibly can. And this is back to my theme, really, of defining the problems that we're trying to solve in that context. So you build in, the inherent design features of transport, for example, that enables that to happen. I think the other area, though, is we have to be prepared to be fleet of foot. You know, somebody said yesterday, technology changes in seven, whatever it is. Sometimes I think it's hours, actually, of mine days. It's impossible, you know, to keep up, even with some of the underlying infrastructure developments are quite hard to keep up with. So whatever we do needs to be designed in such a way that actually has the ability to be flexible and universal. But that's true generally, and I think that's focuses on the business case for doing a lot of this. It would be nice to think that governments, technology companies, etc., transport companies would do what needs to be done for out of altruism, but they won't. They'll do it out of a strong business case. And if the strong business case is made to them, i.e. more people will use whatever they're designing or developing, and there's therefore a cost advantage to them in doing that. That's got to be a factor that drives, you know, how some of this development will happen going forward. So really strong, well-made business cases are important. The final point for me, and I think it's been prevalent throughout most of the presentations actually, is to be able to tell the story. And if you think about how a lot of the developments have come around, whether it's the wonderful, you know, Raymond Kurzweil, or right the way through to developments that we're talking about now, hearing Gus earlier talk about what Meta are doing, a lot of these developments start with a wonderful use case and a wonderful story. It's personal knowledge, and it's driving that through connections that I think is also really crucial. If we can do that at a strategic level and really interest people, as well as actually making the business case, we've got a chance of you know, solutions that actually survive the test of time.
You know, I just want to build on that piece a bit further and just comment that I think that this is the really interesting thing, is that building flexibility and building an adaptable system in. And, you know, one of the things that we've been really proud of with what we do is everything's backward compatible. So, you know, if I go back to the earliest deployments in the UK with TransPennine Express, they bought a solution solely for the blind and low vision. And 4.5 years later, they've now got the solution that C2C and LNER are just putting in that's, you know, exactly what they've got. It's completely backward compatible. It improves over time. And I think that's something that we as a community have got very used to, buying something that's going to need an update or a software patch or buy another £1,000 in a year's time. And getting technology that not only gets better, but is affordable, and the ROI for businesses is evident, is really important. And I think that's really great. So,
I think also, well, I remember it's, you know, engaging brilliant minds as well in this. I loved hearing from the students this morning. It was really inspiring to hear people take a nugget, work with it, albeit over 24 hours, and think what they could do in a month or two. It'd be absolutely amazing. So actually hearing from brilliant minds, engaging, you know, minds as they're actually entering the various professions, I think is crucial. And actually engaging people like that in our organisation. So a shameless plug, we are currently recruiting a lead for our technology programme and services. And if you're interested in that, please go on Guide Dog's website and apply.
thank you, Pete. Jean-Marc, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to build on that excellent point that Neil also made. And actually, I think everyone's been making about rapidly changing technology. I think, yeah, Dr. Webson also mentioned that yesterday. I think technology is getting better and better, but we absolutely should not forget what we're using that technology for. You know, it's akin to, you know, strapping a jet engine to your family car. I mean, it can go faster than any other car, but chances are it's not what you'd like. And I've got an example from WeWalk for this. You know, when we were first looking at the candidate sensors for Smart Cane 2, we stuck to ultrasonics, by the way. People were asking us, well, hey, why not put LiDAR into there? It's surely better than, you know, age-old ultrasonics. Why don't you even use a camera for computer vision? Mm. And you'd think to yourself, man, I've got a point. I mean, LiDAR is, you know, mathematically better at detecting the distances between obstacles and ultrasonics. That's fine. The only issue is it's a lot more expensive. So immediately you've, you know, profiled out a bunch of users who, you know, who might not be able to afford the product. But then on top of that, you realize, wait a minute, LiDAR doesn't really work very well in bright conditions. It would be very difficult for me to go up to visually impaired people and to say, by the way, you should buy our Smart Cane. Just don't use it in the daytime. You know? And if you go to cameras, which is amazing, you know, it's definitely sort of where we're heading with computer vision. And we're looking at that with the RNIB. But once you install cameras in something like this, you've got to up the processing power in your cane. Yeah. Battery life will decrease. And then again, what are you doing it for? So for LiDAR, some people suggested we'll get rid of the cane. You cannot do that. This is, you know, a fundamental taught tool. We rely on the cane. The analog technology should not be replaced by the next highest spec piece of digital technology that's come out there. Absolutely not. We have to stick to our traditions. We have to stick to organizations that teach white cane usage. But then carefully, without a heavy hand, consider the price and performance of the technology that we apply.
Thank you. That's really.
I'm really glad you just said that. I have to just say, and I'm sorry, Pete. I know you were about to say.
It's like we rehearsed this, by the way. But
I've got to say, I so agree with that point that we have to maintain trueness to our O&M taught skills, because this happens so often that we get sighted people trying to understand the implications of deploying technologies like ours at venues, and they turn and say, oh, well, you know, we thought about it and we went out and we tried it at this other location that's comparable to ours. And we just think blind people are going to be falling off platforms and they're going to be dying and it's going to be a disaster. It's like, what on earth are you talking about? They're going to be using a cane or a guide dog. We have taught, learned skills. Please do not apply your, you know, sighted prejudices to this situation. And I'm really glad you said it.
And I want to just build on something which Neil said earlier, was backward compatibility. And, you know, being fully sighted person and technologist, we always talk about disruptive technology. Let's come disruptive. But the entire expertise is all about adaptability. It's not about disruption. It's about how do you do better adoption. So backward compatibility and bringing it to forward is all about that. For example, when we started working on these augmented reality glasses, the idea was, okay, let's remove completely the mobile phone. But when we start using with some of our ambassadors, they have their best songs in Spotify on their mobile, And do you really want to bring them in? So we thought about, let's have an option of pairing them back with mobile phone. And that's the adoption. You know, so for us, the backward compatibility is about user adoption and not just any disruptive high-tech LiDAR can come and change everything. It's not about that. So we need to understand that part much better in an accessibility and inclusivity side of the business rather than just about creating something totally out of the box.
Thank you, Manny. Jean-Marc, did you want to build on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you might be asking yourself now, well, how do we actually tease out these user requirements for us and how to use technology? And this is something, again, we've learned by working with YarnIB. If you go to a room with user testers and you give them your product, again, they're going to think of ways of adding new sensors or adding new functionality. And you'll end up falling into a trap that actually Henry Ford very nicely summarized many, many years ago. And he said, if you ask people what they wanted, they'd ask for a faster horse. And for us, it's how do we actually really tease out what people want, not just in the lab or in specific instances of user testing, but actually in the technology that people use day to day. So when we actually go out and ask people, how can we make WeWalk better for you? We actually don't show them a WeWalk smart cane first. We ask them, how's your microwave at home? Or what's your remote control like? What parts of that do you like? That's a piece of technology that they've been using for years. It's a piece of technology where they've had enough time to formalize what they like and what they really, really hate about it. And when we came out with Smart Cane 1, we were like, we're going to slap on a touchpad onto it, because why not? That was the coolest thing to do. You'd put a touchpad on a Smart Cane, you've got all your gestures, at hand.
Yeah.
And people said, yeah, that's great. In user testing, people said, we'd love a touchpad. That's so high tech. But actually, when going out there, out and about, trying to navigate the touchpad in a real-world scenario after, hundreds of hours of use, people thought maybe we should be going back to buttons, back to how remote controls are now, back to how many car displays are now, going back to old-fashioned buttons because people have really tried it in their day-to-day lives. And I'm sure you guys do that too when you're user testing. Mm.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean-Marc. So I'm going to move us on, but I want to do that by focusing on something Pete said and pulling some of these things together. So there's an interesting thing emerging about, we've talked about a number of specific use cases and some technologies which support some specific new use cases, but that users themselves will often opt for a faster, less smelly horse than the car. But Pete, you talked about the business case, and really the question is, how do we scale some of these technologies if we know that the way to get true scale is to find a way of mainstreaming some of these ideas, integrating them into the mainstream? So the question is, how do we write those business cases, and how do we scope in that wider group of users? So Manny, I was going to come to you. From your perspective, how can partnerships between tech companies and local authorities, transport services, accelerate the implementation of these solutions?
A very good point, I think, because as a young entrepreneur, I should say, I face that challenge, in terms of, can I innovate everything? And honestly, I say no. I need to build innovation and leverage what's already there. So that's the first mindset we created when we started creating these augmented. So we don't produce these glasses. We find the best in the world. Mm. And we bring them and program them with AI. That's the first thing. Then we say, can we find some of the peripherals or accessories that is already built in, whether it's scanners, proximity sensors using ultrasonics? Can we bring them as a... So we try to create an ecosystem. But these ecosystems have them... Once we create it in our lab, we need two things. One, a sponsor to fund it, which we do it from our pocket till now. But then, secondly, one to use it. Am I right? Right now we reach out to their different people, communities, and we find people, and they start loving it and do it. But we feel that the organizations have a much role to play in the evolution of this technology, in creating this collaborative platform. They need to be the incubators. If I come to RNIB, they should say, "This is a great platform for me to connect to." In like-minded people who are addressing one part of the elephant.
Yeah.
And collectively, we can address the entire elephant together. So these kind of incubation centers have to come. Otherwise, I have to find a place of meeting room, go around with something. And user adoption in the accessibility part is much harder because to test my glass, I have to travel someone 200 miles one day.
Yeah.
And then again, after 2 weeks, again, it's not like I can ship it and explain someone. It's a much harder. So if these kind of incubation centers or training centers can be created where the ideas can be generated and collaborated with each other, I think we can find a much accelerated pace. We are in this business out of acceleration. Mm. And it's for me personally, it's a mission for life now. So I'm really enjoying it, but I see that, you know, governments, transportations, organizations like R&B can play a much bigger role in bridging the gap.
So there are these capabilities that exist around the world, but they're not connected to one another.
Absolutely.
Giving different organizations the access to the information, absolutely, the insight, the lived experience which they need to design these great products.
Okay, I do actually echo that. I think that, you know, I was thinking it as I listened to Gus earlier talking, and, you know, it's great, a lot of the relationships that are formed, but they do tend to be very unilateral and monopolistic sometimes. Yeah. And you sort of sit there and say, well, that's great. And, you know, I celebrate, I use it, what BME have done and the Beam AI and so forth. But it's almost as if OpenAI are saying, hey, we're a great bunch of people because we're giving access to this tool and this technology to the blind. And you're giving access to it on a very restrictive basis to one company. And it is monopolistic. There is a lot of that activity that happens. And that's just one example. And what we need to see is these platforms opening up very quickly to allow iteration and to allow, you know, people to try and see what else can be done. But that happens a lot. And, you know, we see it a lot. People often say, oh, why aren't you guys working with X or Y? And it's like, well, guess what?
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
But I guess just adding to that briefly, that in a sense, though, is the nature of commercial development, isn't it? In a sense, people will take a commercial route, and there will be a commercial realization for their activities. For me, the bedrock of this is if you can actually get mission-driven business development, then, you know, you're on to irreversible change. And if I think about the way, you know, for example, Meta and others have approached this, they actually talk about universal design as being central to their core mission. You know, for Apple, it's accessibility is one of their core values, and I heard something similar from Meta earlier on. So if we can achieve that, particularly with the big tech, I think, where you actually got mission-driven business cases and you've got, you know, something that's absolutely essential to their core value set, you've got a situation that's going to be impossible to reverse, which is what we want.
Absolutely. Mm.
Fantastic. Okay, so now this is a question for all of you. Looking ahead to 2035, so 10 years into the future, what does an ideal accessible mobility landscape look like for you?
So I'll jump in first, if I may. So,
so
I've got a really simple one. So I actually want Starship or something like that to be talking about the fact that they've done 10 million guided journeys. That's what I want. So, and I think that's possible, actually. So interestingly, the way in which they're talking about, you know, the how that technology is developing, etc., I'm sitting there thinking, probably for most of us, you know, we do similar journeys, you know, 80, 90% of the time. How far away is actually that technology for enabling something like that? I personally don't mind being guided by a box that's capable of, you know, taking a few bits of shopping as well. That's okay. I'll live with that. But, you know, in general, I think there's a real possibility to actually see that kind of thing happen. So I'd like to be sitting here in a few years' time talking about a commercial that's done X million guided journeys.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Pete. Jean-Marc?
Yeah. I think the first one is scale. I think, obviously, a lot of people have to start small in demonstrating that a product works. And you might find some fantastic results in specific environments, like, for instance, a specific station or a specific shopping mall. But actually, for a visually impaired person, that's not enough. We actually need all of our spaces to be accessible, which then leads me on to the second point, which is gaps being filled where they need to be filled. So, for instance, we work with guide dogs for people who are waiting for a guide dog. They're now being trained up through their wonderful VRS service on deploying the WeWalk Smart Cane to then fill in that gap. And I think in future, we would want to fill in more gaps, not just with WeWalk, but with any other technology that is appropriate for that situation. And then most importantly, at scale. So in every environment. So that you don't have to second guess yourself and go, well, if I wanted to go grab a cup of coffee from that mall, will there be a sufficiently accessible navigation system there in place for me to even do that? That shouldn't even be a question in 10 years.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jean-Marc. Manny?
Well, my perspective is that, you know, 10 years down the line, I would like to see these wearables becoming, you know, with unlimited power supply and unlimited computing, and especially AI. That's what will make it, you know, a robust product. And also, I think these products need to getting started, adopted early in the life cycle. See, blindness is not one-day event. Mm. It's a journey. And I think a lot of us, when I met some of my ambassadors, they have taken the decision very late in life. For example, we work with a painter, a blind braille artist, Clark Reynolds in Portsmouth. When I gave the glasses first time, he was considering himself as blind. For 7 years, he has left the art. Now, using AR technology, he's able to magnify, understand the color, and he's gone back to the drawing back. You know, he started creating paintings again. And that's a good example that a lot of time we lost the capability in our own mind, and we accept that we are blind. So we need to start adopting these technology early. So there's a part of, adoption. There is a part of these hardwares becoming better, robust. And the final thing is about the aesthetic sense. You know, technology need to be acceptable. We always talk about accessibility, but we don't talk about inclusivity. Whenever I gave my glasses to any person, he said, can I see how I look? You know, first thing, when the glasses are on your face, they are your face, okay? They are no more a glass, you know? So technology we need to develop need to be publicly accepted. They need to be part of it. Yeah. And that's, for me, an accessible inclusivity is all about.
Fantastic. Thank you, Manny. And Neil?
I think for me, in 2035 sort of thing, 10 years from now, what I really want to be observing is a situation where we as a community have access in a far more, inclusive fashion to the wider world around us. You know, I want to be able to go anywhere I want to be able to go. I want to be able to pick up anything that anyone else could pick up in that location, access the environment and the products and the opportunities that are there. I think back to my own journey of going through sight loss, and I sort of think about all the milestones in my life, whether it's, going to, retail opportunities, through job interviews and all these things. And I sort of think about, a lot of the underlying, at one end of the spectrum, fear, and a lot of the sort of right through to the absolute unknowing that doesn't happen for sighted people on the same degree and same scale that it does for us. And I think about the ability to be able to say to my kids that are growing up, actually technology and what the society can deliver to you is actually going to make the world so much more, normalized for you, that you're going to be able to walk out the door and you're going to be able to access the world at the same pace that everyone else who doesn't have the disability element kicking in, can. And I think that's one of the real things. And I think that probably plays to John Mark's scale. But pace is, we're hitting a time now where everything is lightning speed. People are dashing around, they're reading, and everything's at a million miles an hour. And for us as a community to be able to partake equally and to be seen not as a person that, that's the blind guy, it's okay, we let him be around, don't worry about it. We have to do more to help us as a community get up to speed, maintain the pace, and have that true inclusion to absolutely everything. And that's where I want us to be. And I genuinely think we're there. We're so on the edge. It's tangible.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you, Neil. So you can go wherever, whenever, however you want. And it's that bit about full inclusion feeling in society. That's fantastic. Thank you all. I want to give some time for the audience to ask some questions now. So if you've got any questions, please put your hand up and we'll get a mic to you. Yes, over here.
Hi there. Thank you so much for that. That was brilliant. My name's Hazel Dixon. I work at CoStar National Lab. A lot of our work focuses on inclusion within the creative industries. And one of the particular sticking points for people seems to be sort of temporary pop-up cultural events, thinking about music festivals and concerts, or all the way to sort of immersive theatre expos, things like that. How do you, and maybe this is a question particularly for Neil, but for sort of everyone, which is, how do you see working with event producers and venues to create accessible, inclusive, pop-up temporary events?
I will give you my good maps answer, and hopefully it'll solve for you. I can delightedly sort of partially announce that we're actually going to be rolling out a technology later this year from July roughly onwards that will allow people to digitalize their venues on a mobile phone so that we don't have to go and do a professional scan. Won't work for massive airports and huge railway stations, but for event spaces and so forth, it will allow you to digitalize that map, produce that map in a heartbeat. So for the type of situation you're thinking about, for going to hotels and sort of just, well, I need to get from the, you know, to my room and so forth. And that's going to become a reality, which will massively increase the scalability of the availability of the solution and the mapped environment. So certainly from our point of view, the way we would envisage, you know, that instantaneity and spontaneity of having access to the built environment, that's our solution that we would be bringing out and that we think will be a game changer for the community.
I promise I'm not an industry plant.
That was a cracking question. We hadn't decided when we were going to announce it, so there it is.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you, Hazel, for your question. This gentleman here.
Thank you very much for such an illustrious presentation. My question again to you, Neil. Sorry. So, how is your Google Maps differ from what is 3D? Three words. What is three words? You know,
they say, yeah, the solution. Yeah. So, what Thank you. Words uses GPS, as does most of the navigation solutions that are widely available on the market. So, you think Google Maps, Apple Maps, and so forth. None of those signals effectively can penetrate structures. So where we're sitting right now, you wouldn't be able to use what free words effectively and reliably. So whilst what free words with their sort of 3 meter squared idyllic sort of positioning would work well in an outdoor environment, firstly, obviously it doesn't have a navigation component to it. So yes, you've got a level of accuracy, but what you don't get is the ability to use that solution indoors. So what our technology does is it brings indoor positioning to people whereby they cannot access radio signals that are normally meant to penetrate structures. So that's the key distinct difference. We're using computer vision, we're comparing the environments, and in a mapping context, we're blue dotting, but we're doing more than blue dotting, we're blue arrowing, so we're able to say what your orientation is in the space, which of course is fundamentally different approaches. GPS also has a huge disadvantage in more built-up areas where you get urban cannula effect, where it's sort of the signals are bouncing off buildings. Our accuracy is down to sub-meter 100% of the time and 25 centimeters 68% of the time. So it's a far more accurate technology.
Thank you. Do you want to build on that?
Yeah, jumping in on this and actually vouching for Neil and Good Maps here, which is it's not just about the accuracy of the positioning as well, but then how you deliver information to the user. So for instance, Google Maps outdoors, yes, can position you very accurately. But the thing that we're lacking is then an interrogable system that you can then ask, am I heading in the right direction? How do I turn? Do I want to use clock-based directions or cardinal directions? Which is where solutions like Good Maps and even and WeWalk come in here, which is it's not just about the accuracy, but it's about then classifying and delivering that navigation, orientation, experience to users. And we consider these the two pinnacle requirements in any part of project design, which is obstacle and hazard avoidance, but then where am I and how do I get to where I want to go?
Yeah. Fantastic, thank you. Got time for one last question.
Hi there. I've heard some really interesting and really positive points about all the products that have been created and being developed for visually impaired or blind people. I just wanted to ask, I've heard a lot about what corporations or companies that are developing these things are doing and what they consider to be their responsibilities and obligations. What hand is government having in aiding with these developments? What are they doing to help with these? And, you know, just so that visually impaired and blind people are not just seen as consumers of a product like anything else that you'd find on a shelf. What is government doing to help with these things? And is there anything that is kind of hindering it from government? when it comes to development.
Yes, I'll help with that as well.
Shall I give the quick and dirty response? Honestly, confusion, disarray, chaos, carnage, and all the other sort of words. So I think the real question is how do we get the government to do more? So I'll give you an example. Every train operating company in the UK has to go to the Department for Transport every single time they want to deploy our product and ask the exact same thing. They get a form to fill in and they have to produce a business case. That is crazy. It is insane. And it is the kind of thing that causes chaos. So what we could do is standardize. We could make solutions obvious and we could help the government across the board come up with a way of saying, okay, if this has been done and we understand why, and then it's just someone else wanting to do it to expand the reach and the availability, we'll do that. And then I would extend that into two other places. We pitched to NHSX 2.5-3 years ago, who declared this is the most compelling solution to a known problem that exists in the NHS. It should be everywhere. And today we have no hospitals because the NHS require a real-world example in a hospital. How do I do a real-world example in a hospital if none of the hospitals will do the first one? So there's all sorts of craziness. I think the only other thing I would reflect on before I hand over to Pete is governments and arm's-length body of the governments, public entities that involve, so airports I'm thinking very specifically here, that are sitting there, who are private but serve enough of the population, they are considered public infrastructure. The public sector equality duty applies. And we seem to have either forgotten that the public sector equality duty exists, or we're just simply ignorantly unaware of it. And the public sector equality duty switches it from a reactive adjustment to a proactive. And I don't know how many people out there today are responsible for any of these venues and so forth, but proactive doesn't mean that I should be coming to you and asking you to do something. It means you should be saying, what can I do to make things better? So that's my big, soapbox moment over with.
Thank you.
We've not got
much time left, so
I'll be quick.
Thank you.
And on to mine, and I will be quick. I think government has a huge role to play in supporting skills acquisition, and Neil touched on this earlier. You know, we can have all the technology in the world, but if people don't know how to use it and they haven't got the base level orientation and mobility skills, the ability to use their vision, the residual vision, immersive audio, and all of the wonderful things that technology can enable, then that's going to be of little or no use. So government supporting education and healthcare plans and actually the realisation of those plans. It's probably less well known about guide dogs, but we're one of the world's largest employers of vision rehabilitation and habilitation staff. But I'd like to see that all across the country. I'd like to see the staff being supported in local authorities throughout the structure. I'd like to see many more QTVIs than we've got now. You know, there's so few actually in the structure, and those people that are in the structure are so hard pressed to deliver services to more people. I think government has a huge role to play in addressing the skills acquisition gap.
Fantastic, thank you, Pete. Jean-Marc.
Yeah, I was kind of really. By the way, I they said that to you too, NHSX. It's quite funny. Yeah? It's great.
It's why we're not paying. And there's a wee walk in every hospital.
No, but I have to say, I agree that the government's great at sort of supporting the R&D opportunities. And there's a lot of grant funding out there. So if you look at the NCAT, for instance, the Innovate UK Healthy Aging Challenges, for which actually has facilitated our partnership with R&D for user testing. I think that real area for improvement, as you said, is just deployment. We've tested it. We've created the evidence package. But then how do we actually implement it and get it there? And I think that's really the point for improvement here. Yeah. But don't shy away from those grants, because there are so many grants, like the Knowledge Transfer Networks, the Social Tech Trust, so many out there that want to help, you know, create this training and these user requirements, derivations. It's just, let's see it through to the end, basically.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Jean-Marc. Thank you very much to all my panelists. And we've come to the end of the session there. So if we can join me in a round of applause, thank you.